Blog Talk Radio.
Healing rain is coming down. It's coming nearer to this old town. Rich and poor, weak and strong. It's bringing mercy. It won't be long. Healing rain is coming down. It's coming closer to the lost and found. Tears of joy and tears of shame are washed forever in Jesus' name.
Inviting a little bit of healing rain into your day. Of any sadness and despair, I pray that your day is filled with His joy, His purpose, His healing. Good morning. I'm Randy Noble. Welcome to The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm really glad that you've taken out a block of time to spend with me. I appreciate that. All of us lead very challenging, busy lives, and I understand your plight. When you spend a little time doing something different, I appreciate that, and I appreciate you this morning. Welcome to the chat room also. You can come in, type in your questions, make your comments. I will try to get to all of them. It's just me, myself, and I. I have no one behind the scenes to help me. Very, very important, special show today. I have two guests. Never done that back-to-back before. My first guest has been on before. Her name is Donya Jam. She is an Iranian-American student activist. I'm so glad I met her. She is very passionate about speaking out for her country, Iran. She's an American citizen, but she speaks passionately about her friends, about her people, and the injustices that go on in Iran. My second guest has also been on The Cross in the Desert. Very good friend, very special lady. Mrs. Tammy Nance from Smart Girl Politics. She's the director of digital media there. She has a very, very important topic today. We're going to talk about the inequality of women. And in the context of that, she is going to talk about her recent trip with her daughter, Anna, to Africa and the experience she's had there. And she's going to compare it to what she says in her blog is a lot of whining and crying that women here talk about hardship and inequality and wanting to make it to be successful. She's going to deal with that subject. And also she has a surprise of a new project that she's involved in. So you really want to take the time to listen to Donya and Tammy this morning. They have some very important things to share. Yesterday, all over the internet, was a very special day for Rahana Jabari. I think it was organized by the We Are Rahana Jabari International page, those behind the scenes, the administrators. It was a candlelight vigil celebration, if you will, where everyone took a picture of Rahana or some candles and lit the candles in front of her pictures to honor her. It's still, even 4 or 5 days later, it is still very painful for all of us human rights activists when we think of the cruelty and the injustice of what was done to Rahana. Rahana was brave, courageous, and she fought to the end. And I think that Rahana represents all abused and discriminated women in Iran and all over the world, that is. She never wavered in her story. Even on the day of her execution, when they tried to cause her to recant, she never wavered. Right now I have my special guest right up on the phone block, Donya Jam, Iranian-American student activist. Welcome to The Cross in the Desert, Donya.
Hi, Randy. Thank you for having me.
Now, I know that you're on a very tight schedule this morning, so I want to get right to what you're going to talk about. We're talking about Rahana. Rahana Jabari, the 26-year-old lady in Iran, honorable lady in Iran, that was executed this past weekend simply for defending herself against a rapist. And I was just mentioning that yesterday was a special day for Rahana. Everyone paid a tribute to her in this candlelight event and posted pictures of her with candles honoring for who she was and what she stood for. What did Rahana mean to you, Danya?
Well, she means a lot to me, actually. She's like a symbol, you know, for defending yourself, you know. I remember in an interview that her mother had with Fox News, I'd like to read what she said.
Yes.
She said, "The government's message to the women of Iran was that you cannot defend yourself in the face of rape or violence, or else you'll be executed. But Rehana, she stood until the end. They even tried to make her confess that the guy that tried to rape her, they tried to make her lie and say that he didn't rape her. But she stood by her story, and she fought until the end. And she taught a very important lesson to Iranian women."
Yes, and she is a symbol, I think, as you said, much like Netta Sultan, who 5 years ago paid the awful price of peacefully protesting against the unjust election. And in many ways, Rahana is that same figurehead. And I've heard from many human rights, Danya, that what happened to Rahana this past weekend is going to cause a firestorm for the Iranian regime.
Oh, yeah.
That this is going to be a backlash they never thought would happen.
You're correct. You're totally correct.
Now, you have had some time to think about this, and all of us have. I've written my blog about Rahana in a personal way, the experience that I had praying for her the night that she was executed, and what happened to me. You've also had a chance to write about Rahana. What is it we need to learn from Rahana? What should we remember best about Rahana?
Well, I'd like to start by saying, like, in my article, I had wrote that, you know, world leaders, you're condemning Rahana's execution, and that's exactly what needs to happen. You need to condemn it. But condemning isn't enough. You need to, you know, take action. You need to make sure this doesn't happen again, because there are more like Rehana sitting in Evin prison, sitting in different prisons across Iran, facing the same sentence. They're awaiting death, and there's a chance, you know, we weren't able to save Rehana, but we can save others, and they just need to take a strong stance for humanity. Or else more like Rehana will die if they don't take serious action.
There was over, Danya, 200,000 signatures worldwide to this petition. There was an international outcry. Protests on the day before the execution in London, in Canada. Canada has publicly decried this execution. I think it was Minister John Baird said something very powerful.
Yes.
He says, "I am outraged but not surprised that the Iranian regime carried out the execution of Rahana Jabari. She was wrongfully arrested for defending herself and killing her attacker who was attempting to rape her. I would like to offer my heartfelt condolences to her family. I personally advocated on a number of occasions for Mrs. Jabari as part of the Iranian Political Prisoners Global Advocacy Project." And this is Minister James Bazan. There has been so much outcry against what was going to happen, and yet they hung her.
Right. It's shocking. You know, I mean, looking at the past 35 years, I'm not as shocked. But still, I mean, it's still outrageous. There was so much international you know, campaigning to end her execution, but this just shows how brutal this regime is. I mean, despite this huge international campaign, they still went and executed her. Unbelievable. And it was said that she even had, you know, the flu. Her mother said that, actually. And she's been tortured so much, and she's a young woman. How could... Unbelievable.
I was just going to add that, you know, that happens. We're both so excited because we want to share from our heart. Rahana wrote prison letters. She made her voice being made known outside of the prison, and in one of her letters, she said, perhaps someone in this world would hear my cries and feel my pain. And you've heard her cries, and you have definitely felt her pain, right?
Oh, certainly. Her messages are heartbreaking. When I've read them a couple times. Well, I've read each one like a few times. I even listened to her own voice. She's so heartbreaking.
Now, Donya, there was a final will that Rahana gave to her mother, I think, back in April. And she made some amazing statements in there. And one of them at the end of this was that she asked her mother to do something for her she couldn't do, and that was make known in writing that at her death, all of her organs, vital organs, would be donated to people in need. What does that say about a person like Rahana, that as persecuted as she was and as much suffering as she went through, she forgave her attackers, she forgave her interrogators, and at the end of her life was willing to do something good for someone else?
It just shows how much of a caring person she was, how innocent she was. And this totally embarrassed the Iranian regime, how they took this young girl and they executed her, and her only crime was defending herself, you know. So she was so caring. She really is a symbol, you know. The things she said in her letters, she said she didn't want to rot underground. She wanted to, you know, donate her organs. Just shows what an innocent person she is. And I'm sure that when she was in prison, God was with her. God was with her through all this. And I think that's where she got her power from, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I share the hurt and pain that you were going through. I remember when she went to the gallows to be executed, I was in the chapel praying. I wrote this in my blog. And I had my cell phone next to me, and I was just praying for God's mercy, for Rahana, for Sholeh. And I'll never forget, Donya, on my phone, there was a video that just came up online. It was a video of Sholeh standing outside the prison in a van in the darkness. You could just see the outline of her face. And she was crying, Akoda, Koda, Koda, Rahana. And it just broke me, because as I was praying for Rahana, here's this video, I'm connecting with Sholeh. And I just really felt their pain at that moment.
Oh, yes, certainly. Those videos that come out from Iran, you know, of Rehana's mother, they were heartbreaking. I wish I could have been there for her. I wish I could have to help her through this. But unbelievable what this regime puts people through. These mothers, I'm sure you've heard of Sattar Beheshti. I remember his mother also. It's just what they're doing to these people in Iran, these mothers, these poor innocent mothers. What did they do to deserve such a thing? How could you execute their children?
It's so cruel, as you're right, how they put mothers through this. And you know, on the time when Rahana was being buried, they took her body to this graveyard. I'm not really sure, a cemetery. There were over 300 security people because they were afraid of a protest, a riot breaking out. And there's a video of Rahana's mother just weeping and wailing over her grave. Come to find out, her own husband was banned from coming to this cemetery.
Oh, my goodness. Again, see, they even torture the family even after her execution. They won't even let them set up a proper ceremony to remember Reyhanna. This just shows how scared this regime is. They couldn't even let her own father attend the... Oh, my gosh. See, I'm not shocked. Oh, my goodness.
It's just horrible, and you know, we can put ourselves in the place of what the family is going through to add insult to injury. There was a memorial planned for Reyhanna, pictures of her, photographs of her as a child, and they wanted to have this in a large hall because of a great turnout, and the regime banned them from the hall, forced them to go into a parking garage. And up on the We Are Reyhanna page, there are pictures of them in this tiny garage, cramped together, to try to remember Reyhanna. And like you said, the cruelty just never ends.
Never ends. Even after her execution, they're still torturing this family. Unbelievable.
Now, I want to take us to a different dimension of Reyhanna. You are contending that when the world community comes and sits down with Iran in about a month over the nuclear situation, that if they're going to condemn this execution, they have no business sitting down and bargaining with Iran. Give me your thoughts on that.
Right, exactly. It just doesn't make sense to me that you condemn her execution, but yet you're ready to go back to the negotiation table and deal with such a regime that's doing this to people. You know, and it's not just Reyhanna. I just read, I believe yesterday, in Urmia prison, the Iranian regime executed another 5 prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
The cruelty doesn't end. If you, condemning isn't enough. If you take a firm stance for humanity, so many lives will be saved. I just don't see why you just condemn it. If you're truly standing by what happened, you need to take further action. You need to prevent and fully stop this regime from taking lives of others.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to also go to another subject that you are passionate about as well, and that is the recent acid attacks that are going on in Isfahan, if I'm saying this correctly. Thank you. There is a petition that you posted that we should be involved with. It's up on my Facebook page. Tell us a little bit about this petition and this group that is speaking out against these horrendous acid attacks.
Yes, there is a petition going around. There are many protests going around in Iran. We want to make sure the world community knows what's happening in Iran. We are sure the acid attacks are just a continuation of the Iranian regime's crimes. They want to suppress the Iranian people. They want to scare them so that anti-government protests don't happen. And in these protests, in Iran, it's shocking because the Iranian regime isn't arresting those who have thrown acid on women's faces. They're arresting those protesting against these acid attacks.
Yes, I saw a posting from you about a young girl now that has been arrested for simply standing up and saying how wrong this was. And in fact, a more prominent person, Nazrin Satuda, was also arrested. She had just gotten out of Evin prison, I think, back in September when Rouhani supposedly released political prisoners. Now she's been rearrested for protesting these acid attacks. It's unfathomable the depths of human rights violations.
Exactly. There is no limits to their cruelty. They're willing to do whatever they can to stay in power. This innocent girl, her name is Mahtia Golru, she was a part of the protests, and I believe Isfahan, and the Iranian regime arrested her and raided her house, confiscated her belongings, and I believe even went to her job and confiscated her stuff there, including her computer. Nazrin Satuda, she was arrested for protesting against these acid attacks. This should tell you something. If you continue deals with this regime, oh my goodness, so many more lives are going to be lost. And it's time, enough is enough. It's time to take a firm stance for humanity.
Exactly. Now, both of us are Christians, and we are concerned about the treatment of Christians in Iran. And we have recently found out that one of the Christians, Benham Harani, has now been given the death penalty in Iran. He's been in prison for many years already simply for being a Christian. And the charge against him is spreading the message of corruption on the earth. That's what they call the gospel of good news. When Benham is in prison and sharing with prisoners, they say, we're going to give you the death penalty, spreading corruption upon the earth.
Yes. This is another extension of the Iranian regime's cruelty. I remember in 1994, this regime, the Iranian regime that's currently in power, they executed many Christians. And during that time, we didn't have things like social media, and we didn't have, we weren't as, our voices weren't as heard as much. So they were able to kill these people. And now the Iranian regime, I mean, throughout their 35 years of ruling, they have started a war against Christians. And this is just a continuation of it. And they're trying to, again, they want to end Christianity. And again, we have to raise our voices for Pastor Behram Irani. And we need to tell the world what's going on. We need to shed international attention to this.
Well, and I want to include to that list, of course, Saeed Abedini. And recently I heard that his mother is being forced to leave Iran. And because they're putting pressure on her because she's standing up for her son who's in prison. And now they say that either she leaves or she'll be arrested. So the continued persecution, as you mentioned, goes on against Christians, against human rights activists, against even women who dare to defend themselves against rape. What, in your final minute here, I know you have to go, tell us what you and I, what the average person listening on Facebook, what they can do to get involved and do something about this.
Sure. So there are many things that we can do. For example, me and you both have a Facebook, and we update people on what's happening in Iran. That's one way. I know we also have Facebook pages. I made a Facebook page, I remember in 2010, it was for a woman who was going to be stoned to death. And it, again, grabbed international attention, and until today, she was saved. But, you know, you can make a Facebook page, make a Twitter page, and then post news of what's happening in Iran. There are many websites. If you go on my Facebook, I'll be happy to recommend websites to you. And also take part in protests. I go to protests in D.C. About a few times a month, and that way it's a brilliant way to raise awareness. It's typically like in front of the White House, and I mean, just message me if you'd like to come, and I can give you details, and we'd be happy to have you there.
Yes, we have a voice to speak with, and I know there's a scripture very near and dear to your heart. In Proverbs 31:8, the Bible says, speak up for those who cannot speak up for themselves. Iranians can't do that because if they do, they can go to prison, but we can speak for them, can't we?
Exactly. It is therefore our responsibility. We're free to go on the internet. We're free to go on Facebook and Twitter. They're not. They're living under an oppressive regime that fears these things. But we have access to Twitter and Facebook. We can protest. We can raise our voices for the Iranian people, and that's exactly what we should do.
Exactly. Well, I want to thank you, Danya, for your passion. I know you have to head off to work, but thank you so much for spending time with me on the cross in the desert, and keep us updated about what's going on in Iran. And thank you again for taking your time. God bless you, dear friend.
Thank you so much. God bless you and your listeners. I wish I could talk longer, but I thank you so much for this opportunity.
Well, you'll come back on again, won't you? And you'll inform us and update us, okay?
Definitely.
Have a great day.
You too.
And that is Danya Jam. Danya Jam is just a passionate lady. She's a university student, and she's an Iranian-American activist. And when you listen to her, you can hear in her voice her determination to make a difference for her people. You know, her parents fled Iran. They lived under two regimes. They lived under the regime of the Shah, and then under the regime briefly of Khomeini, and then they came here. And Danya has never seen Iran. Her parents know all about it. She was born here. And there's a passion in her heart to go back there, but they won't go back until this regime is removed. And you can understand why. Human rights activists would not fare very well in Iran, as you well know. But what I love so much about this family is that they're American citizens, and they could be doing a lot of other things, but they're involved every single day in speaking up for the people that they love so much, and that is their Iranian friends and family that are still there. And they're taking their freedoms as Americans and saying, look, we understand what freedom is like. We feel free here. We can do things that we couldn't do in Iran. And they're taking this beautiful gift of freedom that you and I have, and they're spending time making people aware of the plight of Iranians. I love this. I hope someday soon, they live on the East Coast, I hope someday soon we can connect. I would love to be part of that protest. I remember when I first met Danya a couple of weeks ago, it's only been a couple of weeks, I remember on her page she had a video of the protest in front of the White House, and I looked at all of these well-made signs and these people that were passionate. They were speaking out against the many executions that have happened since Rouhani has been president. They were making us aware of what's going on there. You see, we have the social media now. Like Danya mentioned, about 20 years ago, there was no social media, so Iran could do these things kind of in secret, and no one would know right away. But now we have the power of social media where we can actually get out on the internet and say, this is wrong. And let me tell you something, Iran pays attention to us. They know what we're doing, and they have their little spies and connections. They know that we're well-organized, that we're strong, and that we are relentless, that we're not going to give up. And because of the tragedy of what happened to Rouhani, it's even made us stronger. We will fight harder than we've ever fought before. This is the beauty of social media, where we have the opportunity to say to the world, this is wrong, that we're going to call you to account for what you're doing. And so the power of social media gives human rights activists, as myself and many others, the power of petition, the power of declaring what is wrong. Because let's face it, you can't do that if you live in Iran very well. There's already 8 Facebookers that are in prison right now because on their Facebook page they said or did something that the government got wind of, if you will, and saw it, pursued them, arrested them, and now they're in prison. One of them is a British Iranian citizen. Her name is Roya. She simply said on her Facebook page one day, I disagree with the heavy exact words. She disagreed with how strong Iran was about Islam. They're too strong. In so many words, she said she just disagreed how fundamental they are about Islam in Iran, that they're too stringent, too oppressive, I think. And because of making statements related to Islam in Iran, she was arrested. She got off the plane in Tehran. She's been in prison ever since. Each of them have received sentences of 9 years or more, simply because on their Facebook page they dared to say something that the Iranian government deemed anti-religious. There is no freedom there. And that's why when I have a guest like Danya come on and she talks about her passion for the people of Iran, it blesses my heart because she has the freedom to speak up. And, you know, there are Iranians that live here and won't say anything. Most of them are just so happy to get out of that oppressive environment that once they come here, they want to forget about it all. And, you know, I can understand that. They have been through so much. But I also know many Iranians that say, wait a minute, you live here. You have real freedom. Please do something with it. Do something constructive and positive. And that's what Danya and her mother Miriam have done, and their family. They have taken their freedom and said, we are going to stand for our people. And therefore, a lot of good has been done. It's 10 a.m. on The Cross in the Desert, and I want to welcome now a really, really special guest who's been on before. Her name is Tammy Nance. She is Director of Digital Media with Smart Girl Politics, and she joins me right now on The Cross in the Desert. Good morning, Tammy, and thank you so much for being my guest today on The Cross in the Desert.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Good morning.
Well, thank
you
for coming
back
again.
Pardon my voice this morning.
Oh, you are dealing with the allergies, right, at this time of year?
Yes, I am.
We all understand. We all forgive you because all of us are dealing with it, too. It's just this time of year when it seems like everything hits the air. I want you to tell our audience a little bit about the work that you do before we talk about your topic. I first met you over a year ago at Smart Girl Politics. What a wonderful group of young ladies from all over the world that are taking a conservative stand. Tell us about your job and a little bit about Smart Girl Politics for those of us that may not know.
Well, Smart Girl Politics was started by two moms who saw the need for a place for women to connect, for women to, conservative women mostly, to just get together mostly over the internet is where it started, just to network and to be with like-minded people. There was no place like that on the internet. And when they started it, it was wildly successful almost immediately, to about 45,000 members just on the networking site. And so it's grown over the years and really just really remains something where women connect online, mostly because most of us are very, very busy and we're located across the country. We do come together once a year in different various locations for a Smart Girl Summit, which is where I met you. But what I do is just I run the social media part of it, and the blog and the website, and we're kind of going through a transition right now, trying to figure out, you know, what's next. You know, as you know, in social media, things are always evolving, and so we're kind of in a transition period right now. But with this election, everything's kind of focused on that at the moment.
Yeah, this is a very important midterm election coming up where we can take the balance of power back into the Senate and make a difference in our country. And I know, I hope and pray, Tammy, that people will get out and vote on this day. We got to do this.
Oh, I do too.
Now, thank you for letting us know a little bit about what you do there in Smart Girl Politics, but you just did something very recently that I think is very related to your job, but it was a very different experience. You and your daughter, Anna, decided to see the other side of the world, and it relates to something that we talked about back in January. We talked about the war on women and how the media, the liberal media, tries to paint this picture of how oppressed women are here, especially by Republicans. This trip you took to Africa was a life-changing trip, and I want to talk a little bit about that. You came back from that trip, and you took issue with some statements by our vice president about women. Explain that.
Well, you know, I wish I had pulled up my article because I can't remember the exact statement he made, but he implied that, you know, women here just essentially are very oppressed, like what you're talking about. It hit me at just the right time. I think it was a day or two after we got back, and it really struck a nerve for me because I came from a place where women live under a much different, you know, it's a different culture, and women are treated very differently there. And I saw how women live in another part of the world where, you know, I wouldn't say that women where we were are oppressed, but they are, the culture is so different. I mean, they're able to move freely, and it's a lot different than what your normal topic is, you know, on the women in Iran. Women are able to, you know, move about freely. They don't have to wear the covering, things like that. But you know, it's very normal in their culture for men to beat women and things like that. Uh-huh. So, but more than that, what I witnessed there was just the conditions under which those people live. They're so poor.
Yes.
And so
yes.
I'm forgetting the statement at the moment that he made.
Well, let me help you. Let me help you here.
Great.
There's actually a couple. This was Women's Equality Day, and the White House said,
that's
we
right.
continue the righteous work of building a society where women thrive. And Vice President Biden followed it up saying, I will not rest until my granddaughters have every single right my son and grandsons have here.
That's right. Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's just baloney. It really is. We do. We are so blessed in America to have equal rights. You know, I cannot stand by and be quiet when I hear statements like that, especially out of our vice president. And
yes.
Boy, the White House made a similar statement that day, or implied that women are not treated equally in this country. And it's just not true. And the left continues to put forward that narrative. When you have, you know, the leader of the free world making statements like that, or, you know, his assistant or his vice president, it's irresponsible. And I don't know, I just, it looks so petty and small of us to talk like that when women are suffering like they are in places like Iran and you know, and even in places like Africa where we went.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a life-changing experience. You took your daughter with you, and she did some videoing of it and some pictures. And what I found so striking is the picture, the black-and-white picture on your Facebook page of this young lady, and she's carrying something, but they have to walk back and forth to get water that is contaminated. And this is just one example of the plight of these people in Africa. You went to a place called Toga. Now, it's in West Africa, and I'm thinking right away, a lot of people that are listening are saying, Tammy, what about the Ebola virus? How did you manage to overcome your fear and go there with all of this beginning to happen?
You know, from the very beginning, I had real peace about going. Of course, back when we decided to go and began raising our money, this was not, you know, Ebola wasn't on our, I'm sorry, my phone is beeping. Ebola wasn't on the radar, really. I mean, of course, it's been a problem for a while. We made the decision to go, and I just had a real peace about it and honestly never worried. We got in the country, and they were very vigilant. I felt like at the airport there in Lomé, in Togo, where we flew into, they examined every person that got off the plane as we walked into the terminal. It was a doctor in a white coat that was examining. So I felt like they were being very vigilant. I worked with the doctor a lot of the time. I really just was never afraid. I think that was just the Lord giving me peace.
Yes.
About the situation.
Now, the group that you are working with, Mentor Leaders, that helps with child sponsorships, I'm really glad to hear there's child sponsorships. I work in a bookstore at Family Christian where our emphasis is on World Vision. But in this village you went to, they're basically abandoned by their own government, and the people of Bengal, they live in harsh conditions, no clean water, no access to medical care, schools, or even the most basic conveniences. Wow.
Yeah. This particular village, because of the water situation, had been abandoned. The government just kind of wrote them off because they could not. They drilled for water and couldn't get water when they began drilling wells, and so they gave it up. It became kind of a wasteland, and the people that live there are squatters. They're considered squatters, I think the latest numbers I've read is that there are about 11,000 men and boys there. They do not count the women and children, but nobody exists on paper that lives in Bengal. So it's so sad, and the water situation is so dire. You know, when we go there, one of the things that we do is we set up a clinic and we treat, we have a doctor with us and a nurse, and we treat, the children first and foremost, because we have a school. But then We also have in the afternoons, adults will come and be treated. And so we see waterborne illness constantly, and we can treat that, but the minute we leave, you know, after the medicine wears off, they're going to have the same, you know, illness come back. You know, they get the worms and the parasites and all that. And so the need is great for more wells. We have dug one well. We're about to do, Anna's trying to put together a video now on the story of how the first well was dug. They dug three, I think on the third try they hit water, and there's a whole big long story there. But the Lord let them hit water almost immediately, and it was really amazing. And there's a complete miracle about how it happened. But so they've struck water. They know there is clean water there because they struck it once. And so the goal this next year is to raise $400,000 to buy a drilling truck so that they can begin drilling for water all over the village, because then they can really begin to save lives. And not only the physical lives of the villagers, but also, you know, it's a huge, women right now, most of the women, one of their primary jobs, like you said, is to take that long hike to the watering hole. Now, in dry season, that is extremely long. It's about 15, 20, sometimes more kilometers, depending on where they live in the village. During the rainy season, it's a little bit shorter. It's about half that, but they go, and we went to the watering hole because we were there during rainy season. So we took it was still quite a long walk to the watering hole there, and it was a mud pit, and that's the cleanest it gets. And while we were there, a lady had come, and she was one of the fortunate ones. She has a donkey and a little cart, and so she had brought her jugs and in the back of her cart and was filling up. And while she was filling her jugs, a couple of big cows came and walked in and began drinking beside where she was filling. And that was just a very clear picture of how they live.
You have this clear picture in your mind and in photographs, right? And so you're coming back and sitting on the plane, and you're thinking about these harsh conditions. You're thinking about, and you paint the picture so well, you're thinking about this contaminated water that needs purification, that takes a lot of money to do. And then you're hearing this statement by Vice President Joe Biden, and I can imagine you're sitting there going, do you have any idea what I just witnessed, Joe?
Yeah, and he clearly either does and doesn't care because it's about politics and, you know, playing politics, or he's never, you know, never witnessed something like that. I don't know how you could witness it and not be changed by it. Not only that, we came back and the little contest was going on where people were dumping cold water over their heads. I think it was the ALS Water Challenge.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I'm not one of these that gets all uptight over. I mean, you know, people aren't doing it because they're purposely trying to waste water. And so I didn't say much of anything, but it really bothered me because I had just come from a place where water, you know, the clean water where we were specifically, we're careful with it because it's not, you know, tons of people have to drink out of that well, but outside of the immediate area where we were, they, you know, those buckets of water that people were dumping over their heads would give life to these people. And so, you know, obviously people don't know that, and we're halfway across the world, but still it bothered me.
And the women in this village have multi-lives, multi-tasks. They wear more than one hat. We're not just talking about the carrying of water. They also have to do the laundry, some of the cooking, the farming. Women have a lot of responsibility in these villages.
They really do. They carry a huge, you know, most of the men are farmers. And then when they're done with their work, it seemed like, now I don't know this firsthand, but what I witnessed was it seemed like when men would get done, they would make their way into the market, and that's where they would congregate and drink. And the women we witnessed were up before dawn, and they were working all day and well into the night. And, you know, it's kind of like the job of being a mom, as we know it, you know, it's never ending. But they're in the fields. Most of the time they're carrying a baby on their back while they're working in the fields. And, you know, and then they're cooking, and they don't have a kitchen like we do. They live in grass, you know, mud huts. So, yeah, it was one of the moments I think that touched me the most was the place, the Mentor Leaders Campus. We've built a church and a school, and there are 200 students that go to the school there from within the village. A lot of them are orphans. And so the women work all day long, from very wee hours in the morning and all day long. They cook meals, for two meals a day for these children. And so we decided, you know, we would help them with dishes. That was the least we could do. And we went over and sat down and helped them. You know, they squat and wash dishes in these huge pots. And there was something about that act that really touched me when we went over and began washing dishes the first day. And, you know, they got us stools, but they wouldn't take them. And they sit and squat, and they literally wash dishes for 200 plus kids, you know.
Wow.
And in pots, you know, squatting. And it takes them, you know, by the time they're done, it's time to start cooking for the next meal. And so it had a real impact on me. For some reason, that act of service really melted me into tears that day. So
Now, a lot of these women are married off, as you wrote in your blog, at the age of 13 and 14.
Yeah.
Wow.
They are.
And, you know, think about your own daughter and the age she is. I mean, can you imagine your own daughter being married at that age?
I can't. And then, you know, the girls that aren't married are given great responsibility. They have pretty much the same responsibilities that their moms have. You know, one of the other things that had a big impact on me right away was the seeing the young girls, and I'm talking about, you know, 8 or 9, carrying siblings around on their back, tied to their backs, as they went about their day, you know, I guess babysitting, because mom probably has one on her back too. You know, it's a hard life for these girls. And so when we go in there and someone sponsors a child and they're able to go get an education, it takes literally a weight off their backs, you know, especially the girls, because they're able to come and get an education and eat a meal and,
yes,
you know, have a life outside of farming and, you know, working so hard at such a young age.
These are the things that you and I do every single day. We go to the faucet, turn it on, we sit down and have a meal, we get in our car, we drive someplace. We don't have to walk very far. Most of us won't, unless we belong to Weight Watchers and they tell us, park as far away as you can and walk. That helps you get your exercise. But we have no clue. And it seems like our own president and vice president doesn't have a clue, and they should, of these conditions.
Well, the president's own family lives in much the same conditions, his family that's in Kenya. I've never been to Kenya, but I'm from what I'm told, it's not much different than the conditions where we were. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things that struck me, too, is while we were there, we had a girls' camp. We held a girls' camp for a purity camp for teenagers. And these we brought girls in from all over the country. We were in the far north, on the opposite, you know, tip of the country from where we flew in. And some of the girls that came from the city, so they brought a, you know, small suitcase. But the girls that came from the rest of the country literally showed up. And my daughter had just come back from summer camp, you know, where she takes, you know, half of what she owns, you know, to camp.
Yeah.
And these girls showed up, and their sleeping mats, they were going to be sleeping on cement floors, and they brought grass mats to sleep on, and they brought a charcoal bag with, usually most of them, it seemed, had one outfit that was fancier, and then they had some sort of probably a work outfit. And each night the girls would go and wash their fancy outfit to wear for the next day. And so you'd see at dusk, you would see all their outfits laid out on the ground where they had just washed them. And it was very humbling for my daughter because the van showed up and the girls had just piled in, and probably 50 girls in this little van. And on top, the luggage rack when we arrived in Bengal literally was almost as high as the van itself. On top of the van, it seemed like the van would tip over. I was sure it was gonna. And there was just a little hump on one end of the van where their luggage was, and it was just a clear, very clear picture of, you know, what we have and what they have and how blessed we are. And so they get off and they have no luggage except these little things, and they're there for a week. And it was just, I don't know, it was very humbling. And they have such sweet spirits. There's a very, very clear, it is very, very obvious who knows Jesus and who does not. You can look in their eyes and just read them. So it really humbled me, just the fact that we have so much. Even our poorest have far more. You know, these people live in mud huts. They sleep on a grass mat. Sometimes two or three people will sleep on a grass mat. Most of them, if they do have shoes, they have one pair of shoes. If they have, you know, clothing, they have usually one or two outfits. That's it. And even the wealthier people, like the chief in the village, which is where a lot of the pictures we got of the huts and all come from, are very similar in what they have.
You mentioned their sweet spirits, their smiles. You can tell in their faces who knows the Lord and who doesn't. In spite of their dire conditions, it seems like there's an air of contentment about them. They have a contented spirit that they say, in spite of my poverty, in spite of my harsh conditions, if I have Christ, I have everything. And they have that sweetness. That speaks volumes to me, just listening to you describe that.
Well, it does. And, you know, I went there thinking I'm going to be a real blessing to these people. And humbly, you know, I mean, I didn't know what to expect, but I just knew, you know, here I am. I'm an American, and I've been blessed with so much. And I'm going to go over here, and I'm going to really be a blessing to these people. And I got there, and immediately I knew who was going to be a blessing to who. It was going to be the other way around. Now, I'm not saying that we weren't able to do for them, and I'm sure that they would say, maybe tell a much different story. But just the sweet spirit and the passion that those who know Jesus, that with the passion with which they serve the Lord, is just I've never seen anything like it. Anna and I experienced it wasn't the first night we were there, but it was the first night that we really had a whole lot of interaction with the pastor that is a part of, because what Mentor Leaders does is we go in basically and we set everything up, but we have nationals that run everything because we want it to be about their culture and their, you know, it's for them and it's their, you know, because one day we're going to pull out once they are self-sustaining and we're going to hand it over and move on, and they're going to be the ones left there to run it. So we start them out that way. And so the pastor told us, he said, you know, I like to go in the church at night and, you know, the Saturday before the Sunday services and just have a time of worship if you'd like to join me. And we were all so tired, and I remember thinking, do I have to? Because, I mean, you know, we hadn't quit running since we had gotten there. And so, but I got my shower and walked on over, and I remember Anna doing the same, and of course our entire team, and we trickled in. And as I walked in the church building, I hear this intense pleading in another language, and I didn't know what was going on. And I walked in, and the pastor is laying on the floor with just on his face before God, and he's praying. And I couldn't understand most of what he was saying. I speak a little tiny bit of French, but not enough to get past, you know, what my name is.
Right.
And he was praying, and all I understood was the name of Jesus. And he prayed like that for about an hour. And Randy, I have never been in a place where I felt the presence of the Holy Spirit like I did that night.
Wow.
And David, our leader, after Pastor was finished, began with a devotional, and then we continued continued sharing, and all of us began to share, and he said, you can leave at any time. Don't feel like you have to stay. This is just a time of worship, and come and go as you please. And nobody wanted to move. And we began to, you know, we would sing and had just the most gorgeous voices, you know, singing. And then someone would pray, and it was just, we were able to be a real blessing to that pastor that night, because I don't think he'd had that kind of fellowship in a long time. But he was such a blessing to us, because he would begin to pray as we would sing, and he just, I've never seen worship like that. And it was like I heard Priscilla Shirer say one time that she was ruined after she experienced worship like that, because she never wanted it to be different again. And I came home saying that. I said, I'm ruined. I don't ever want to worship the Lord any other way than to have my whole heart in it like this, like it was that night. And it was a real, that night was life-changing for my daughter. Life-changing.
Wow. And you've had this life-changing experience. You've seen this other side of the world. You have been so blessed by them, as you said. What can you do now, Tammy, to take this experience back to us? And what is the message you have for your people in Smart Girl Politics, what you do? What do you have to say based on what you've just experienced?
Well, you know, that's been the hard part for me, because I came home and it's been hard for me to know where to even start, because there is so much that needs to be done. And, you know, I think as far as those, the people of Vinjal, what we can do as far as the people there is, you know, I came home with a real burden for raising funds for clean water for them. But beyond that, you know, as Christians, praying for these people and then that sort of thing, sponsoring children, you know, all of the things that go with, you know, a humanitarian effort or missions effort, you know, of this kind. But, you know, I came home and really began to just try to talk about the differences, what I witnessed, how women there live and how blessed we are. And yes. Teaching or begging people really just to be thankful for what we have and to see things in, you know, in that perspective. And one of the things that we've been able to maybe use a little bit to that end is, you know, the pictures that my daughter took and some of the video and really just painting a picture for people. And I really haven't done a very good job of that yet, because I came home so overwhelmed, and I hear it's very normal. I came home so overwhelmed because I just don't even know where to start. But, you know, one of the ways that I would like to start is working with people in our own country, within our own borders, who need help, because there are people here that are in dire conditions that need help. And so there may be people that want to do something, but they can't go to Africa, or maybe they're just not willing, or it's not something that God has called them to do. We can't all go. And so finding something here to pour yourself into where you're really making a difference, whatever that might be in your own community.
Well, that brings me to a question. I know you can't talk a whole lot about this, but God has burdened you with a project here in the States, as you said, people that are hurting. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, the Brandon Darby with Breitbart News has been reaching out to me in recent months and kind of planted the seed for the burden that I have for sex trafficking victims. People, I think, are largely unaware of the fact that within our own borders, there are millions of girls and boys being trafficked, and many times under our own noses, hiding in plain sight. And it's a hard thing to tackle, because people don't want to talk about it. You know, it's kind of a new thing that it's become a huge problem, and it's a lot of states. I think Wyoming was the last, was the 50th state to implement, you know, trafficking laws last year. Before that, it was the state of West Virginia. They were the last two who, this is so new. And so what we, I began to share my burden with David, the director of Mentor Leaders, when we were in Africa. And he said, you know, God's put that same burden on my heart. And so we began just praying what in the world we're supposed to do with that, because it's such a huge issue, and trying to figure out where to go and what to do and how to do it is a big task. And yeah. So we began to pray and research, and the Lord has put a couple of locations on our hearts where we're looking at the potential of going and possibly putting in a safe house and really partnering with law enforcement and other ministries to go in, not to be the people who go in and take over, but to go in and work alongside these other ministries and be a help on this issue.
That's wonderful. I'm really happy to have you today, because I think the way that you've explained this to me has painted such a powerful picture in my heart. And for people that want to do what you do and get involved with the Lives of Children being a sponsorship, tell us about Mentor Leaders.
Mentor Leaders was founded by really a young guy, about 10 years younger than me. I'm in my 40s and he's in his 30s. I'll leave it at that. But he wanted to get into ministry. He's an entrepreneur, but he wanted to do something in ministry. And so he began to figure out a way, and he went on a trip through Togo and met Pastor William, who is the guy who took over the church there in Bindal. And they began to seek the Lord's guidance on where to go. And the Lord led them through a series of events to Bindal. And so he created Mentor Leaders as a way where we go in and we just assist in areas where there is nothing, where they have, you know, a huge need. And one of the things that we do is people back here in the States can sponsor children to go to school. And 100% of the funds that people put into that, right now it's $35 a month, and 100%, every single penny of that money goes toward educating, feeding, everything, clothing that child. And I saw firsthand when we were there, because we had brought all the children in for clinic and all those things, they also get medical care and all that, and the kids who are sponsored, you know, we were caring for. But there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kids who come around who don't yet have a sponsor. And they stare in the windows, and you just can't, you want to feed them all. But if you began just handing out, you know, if you began to feed them all and didn't have some sort of a standard set in place, you'd have half of West Africa coming up, you know, there. So it broke my heart, and I kept asking, why can't we feed them? And we do, when there are leftovers, we certainly do. But the kids who are in the sponsorship program are taken care of first. And it was such a huge blessing. I sponsored a child while we were there, and came home, and my mission became, okay, we need to raise money for drilling wells, but let's get these kids sponsored and in school, because it changes their lives. So people can go to mentorleaders.org and, click on the sponsor a child link, and it's $35 a month, you know? It's nothing for us compared to what we're giving them.
It's less than $2 a day, and what you would go to Quick Trip and buy a soda, you can put aside for that child to be fed.
Yes. And, again, I can't stress enough, I know the people that run the organization very well, and 100% of the funds go to the child. The people who run the organization, they raise their own support. They do not take from those funds for their own paycheck.
A lot of these organizations, and I won't mention names, will give the child, the sponsored child, some money, but they don't get it all. A lot of the corporate tax gets involved and other things become involved. But your organization, 100%, that's fantastic.
It is, and it is very unusual, and I've been there. I've witnessed it. I see what's going on. I see how these kids are being taken care of. They're being loved. They're being fed. They're being taken care of medically. When there's a medical emergency, Often, you know, there is no doctor there, so they have to be taken sometimes all the way across the country, depending on the severity of the situation. And so when there's a need, it's taken care of because of people who are supporting the children. So.
Well, I just appreciate, Tammy, in the midst of the allergy season, you taking time and being brave and coming on and just sharing your heart and passion for these children in Africa. And the way you paint the picture, there should be a lot of response to this. Thank you so much for joining me today on The Cross in the Desert. God bless you for taking your time and making us aware of these needs.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
No problem. That's Tammy Nance from Smart Girl Politics, and Mentor Leaders is the name of the group that she's associated with, and it sounds like a very worthy organization that will help these children that are having so many problems and so many needs, and they need to find someone to be a sponsor for them. And so mentorleaders.org, I highly recommend them, and I'm thanking Tammy for taking the time today. I want to take a couple of minutes and play this song from years ago by Rob Frazier. And we're talking about oppressed women. We're talking about villages that live under oppressive conditions. And it comes right down to Jesus is all you need. I want you to hear this very special song right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
Your heart is untrue and your love.
Mr. Rob Frazier from many years ago, I think 1984, a beautiful song, He Is All You Need. I want you to hear this very good interview. I don't know the words to describe it, this powerful interview with Lisa Daftari of Fox News and Sholeh Pakravan, the mother of Rehana Jabari. I want you to hear this interview because no one explains it better than the mother of Rehana, what she has just suffered. And when this is over, I want to share with you the experience I had when this execution took place. So let's listen to this very powerful interview right now on the cross in the desert.
The Iranian government executed 26-year-old Rehana Jabari over the weekend. Rehana was hanged for what authorities call premeditated murder, but what she and her family maintained was self-defense against the man who allegedly tried to rape her. After already serving 7 years in prison, her case garnered much international outcry, many believing there was foul play. Fox News did an exclusive interview with Sholeh Pakravan, Rehana's mother, just a few weeks ago, who urged her daughter's supporters to speak out in an attempt to save her life. She now joins us only 48 hours after her daughter's execution. What was the last conversation you had with your daughter? What was her state of mind?
I went to see Rehana on Friday. It was with my husband, my other daughters, my parents, and my sister. Rehana comforted us, but she knew this was the end. She said there has been increased crackdowns and pressure on all the prisoners. She told us not to mourn her, not to be upset. It's so difficult, but I'm really trying to hold it together and to honor my daughter's wishes.
Had authorities given your daughter any warning? What had they told her?
They told her she had to go in front of his family to be pardoned and forgiven by them. They told her she had to confess that there was no intention of rape, and then maybe they would excuse you from execution. Then they brought in cameras into the room where sentences are carried out, and they kept pressuring her to confess that Zarbandi was not trying to rape her, and Rehana refused.
And you also went to the family to ask them to forgive your daughter, right?
We went to their family many times, begging them to forgive Rehana, but they didn't accept. But unfortunately, the day her execution was carried out, there were so many corrupt people there that they helped the Zarbandi family exit through a back door. Others tried to stop them, to ask them to forgive Rehana, to ask them to drop the charges, but they did it in a way so that we did not run into the family. We didn't have a chance to see them again.
As difficult as it is, take us through the day of the execution, how you were notified, how the family was told that your daughter was killed.
On Friday, when we saw Rehana for the last time, they never told us which prison she would be taken to. We spent the entire night going from one prison to the next, till morning. We were shivering in the cold, both from the cold and from our nervousness. But I tell you, we still had hope. We had hope that Zarbandi's son, Jalal, would finally admit the truth and to pardon my daughter, or at least we were hoping the sentence would be postponed again. It was 7 a.m., and I was sitting in the car because I was so cold. And two of the women came to the car, and as they opened the door, they were crying. In that moment, my entire brain froze. I became paralyzed. Moments later, I just began screaming. I couldn't believe it. They killed my Rehana.
What did the authorities say to you at that point? Did they say anything to you or the family?
Absolutely nothing.
Rehana had so many supporters and advocates around the world. What's your message to those people?
I need your help. I am asking all the countries in the world who defend human rights and women's rights to investigate Rehana's case in international court. Maybe other courts can prove my daughter's innocence. The government's message to the women of Iran was that you cannot defend yourself in the face of rape or violence, or else you'll be executed.
Now I want to talk about the funeral. Were the proper dignities given to your daughter? Were you allowed to bury her in the way that you wanted?
In Iran, we have a custom of preparing the body in a certain way before the funeral. They had secretly done all of this without us. There was heavy security presence there. My husband and I, the rest of the family, we were told by security that we weren't allowed to touch or to get too close. They wanted to carry out the entire burial without us. We pushed our way to the front and begged them to allow us to participate in my daughter's burial. Of course, they didn't listen, and even the burial, our last chance to say goodbye, wasn't in our own hands. Right now in Iran, all of the media is reporting that this man did not intend to rape Rehana and that Rehana had every intention to murder him. I have no way of getting through to any courts here in Iran. In the same way that they killed my daughter, they will continue doing this to young people. They brainwash the people of Iran. They corrupt people's minds.
And I know Rehana left behind a very detailed will. How did she want to be remembered?
Today I cried so much. I was looking at pictures of Rehana. There is such a deep, deep pain in my heart. My beautiful daughter, she was beautiful in every way, a beautiful face, a kind heart. They killed her. What more can I say? She also told me that she believes in an afterlife. She told me not to worry, because in the next world, she would seek justice for the injustice she endured. From the judge, from the officials, from Sarbandi himself, those who tortured me in prison and did not spare me from my pain. My daughter forgave everyone that did this to her. She reminded me to forgive so you can grow, so that your heart can be at peace. Rehana had already forgiven all those who had tortured her. She said she would try to prove her innocence to them in the world to come, but in this lifetime, she had already forgiven them.
I thank you for speaking with us so shortly after receiving this awful news, and I wish you and your family comfort at this difficult time. Thank you for joining us.
That's Lisa Deftari of Fox News interviewing Sholeh Pakravan, the mother of Rehana Jabari. Just a powerful, powerful interview, just 48 hours after the execution. And what Sholeh says at the end just touches my soul so deeply, that Rehana had forgiven everyone involved with what they had done to her. But in the next world, she would seek justice. And we as human rights activists completely understand about this subject of injustices. And we are doing our very best to be a voice for Rehana. Next Wednesday would have been her 27th birthday. What I want to do is share my experience I had during this execution. much like what Tammy Nance has just shared with us about her overwhelming, life-changing experience going to Africa and seeing the harsh conditions. This is my newest blog about Rahana, and it's called The Final Word. Rahana writes in one of her prison letters, "Perhaps someone in this world would hear my cries and feel my pain." Kota Kota, Farsi for God, God, Rahana, Rahana, for as long as I live, I will never forget the agonizing and gut-wrenching cries of Sholeh Pakravan as she received the painful news of her daughter's execution. I was quietly praying for Rahana inside of the chapel at work during my break time. It was 9 p.m. on a Friday evening in St. Louis, Missouri, and approximately 6:30 a.m. in Tehran, Iran. Dawn had just broken over Evin Prison, and despite international outcry and a petition containing over 200,000 signatures, the Iran killing machine hanged 26-year-old Rahana Jabari, an innocent martyr for the crime of self-defense. No doubt, the final words of her daughter were racing through Sholeh's mind at that agonizing moment, quote, "I love you. I wish I could have hugged you until I died." I had been in the middle of praying when I discovered this haunting video on my cell phone. I stopped for just a minute, and as I watched dear Sholeh in her agony, I wept and pleaded with God for his mercy. Let me just explain something there I didn't write. You see, I was in the chapel praying for Rahana, and I had my cell phone there because I wanted to keep up with everything that was happening so rapidly. And this video popped up. It was a video of Sholeh sitting in a van, the darkness kind of obscuring her face. There was just enough light to see her, and she was in agony. And I cannot describe to you this experience. You're in the middle of praying for someone that you've been fighting for, and all of a sudden you have this video of her mother. It was like I was linked with them at that moment when Rahana was being executed, and I was linked with her mother. And it's an experience I cannot put into words adequately. It's something I'll never forget. I remembered at that unforgettable moment, I truly connected with both Rahana and Sholeh. I felt their pain. I was gripped by their suffering and agony. Indeed, I heard their cries, and it is at this moment that I will never forget for the rest of my life. At that unforgettable moment in the prayer chapel at work, I really connected with them. The day that this brutal and unforgiving regime hanged Rahana and thrust a sword of injustice through the mother's heart was only 11 days until her 27th birthday. For 7 agonizing years, Rahana had suffered in prison for the stabbing death of Morteza Sarbandi, a former Iranian intelligence agent who had lured her into his apartment to do some interior designing work and then tried to rape her. From the age of 19 until her unjust death at the young, tender age of 26, Rahana had never experienced a normal adult life. Quote, "The world allowed me to live for 19 years. Rahana writes in her prison letter, part one. "I want them to know what happened to me at the age of 19 that has made me no longer fear." For Rahana, her life had stopped. Her life ended at 19 when she was thrust into the grave of Evin Prison. Yet, in spite of her suffering, Rahana cried out to the world through her prison letters, which became her voice to anyone who would listen to her cause, her side of the story of what really happened. "With a hanging rope in front of my eyes, I want to tell you everything that I said in court, everything that I screamed while I was brutally kicked by 4 forceful interrogators who regarded themselves as almighty. Perhaps someone in this world would hear my cries and feel my pain. For more than 6 months, I heard the cries and felt the pain of Rahana. My Facebook page was filled with petitions and stories about her plight. I wrote a blog about her entitled The Crime of Self-Defense and pleaded with my listeners on my radio program to be a voice for Rahana, save her life, and sign the petition for her freedom. For 1 month before her execution, I paused from work at break time and went to the chapel and prayed for her. I was confident that God heard the cries of the oppressed and suffering and would deliver Rahana. It was only an hour after watching the agonizing video in the chapel that I received the tragic news on my cell phone that Rahana had been executed. I paused from my work at the hospital and I found a quiet place and went to my Facebook page. With tears streaming down my face, I wrote the following post to my Facebook friends. With sadness and brokenness, I have to report that our dear Rahana was executed just a few minutes ago. I am truly broken, and yet part of me that is rejoicing now, because Rahana is finally safe at home in the arms of Jesus. Death no longer has power over her. The Iranian regime has lost. They can no longer hurt her. Jesus had the final word. Rahana, we love you and we'll miss you, but one day soon we will see you again at the great banquet table in heaven. Jesus had the final word, not the cruel and barbaric Iranian regime. During his suffering for his Christian faith on the island of Patmos, John had an incredible vision of Jesus that encouraged him in the midst of a dark trial. John fell down in worship as Jesus laid his right hand upon him. Fear not, I am the first and the last and the living one, John. I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and Hades. This is a powerful and comforting claim from the one who conquered death, hell, and the grave. Jesus is the sovereign Lord over life and death. He has the final word, which means that at our moment of death, we are safe and secure in his arms of love. I pray for Rahana to be delivered, but God did something even more beautiful. He took her out of her suffering and answered our prayers. It was just 10 days before her birthday. For the past 6 years, Rahana has spent her birthday behind the bars of a dark and cruel prison. However, this year, November 5th, on what would have been her 27th birthday, Rahana is finally free. A powerful moment I've never, ever had before, and I'll never forget. Sholi is asking us as human rights activists to pursue this, that her be reopened and evaluated by an international court. I hope and pray that this will happen and that this matter will finally give closure to a woman who is broken over the agonizing death of her daughter. Thank you so much, Facebook followers and friends, for doing what you did to speak out for Rahana and sign the petition. You made a difference, a big difference in her life. She is the one that wanted this campaign. You became her voice. She said, perhaps someone in this world would hear my cries and feel my pain. You did, and that blessed her beyond anything that you could ever imagine or think. So thank you for your dedication, for speaking out for her, because at the moment of her execution, she was calm. She was resilient. Thank you so much for joining me today, Tammy Nance and Donya Jam, on this very special edition of The Cross in the Desert. God bless you for everyone in the chat room, from Mary to Vito. Thank you for coming. I will see you soon again on The Cross in the Desert.
Healing.